Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. African Americans represent 12% of the U.S. population, but accounted for 44% of estimated new HIV diagnoses in 2014. The virus is expected to infect an estimated one out of every black man and one out of every 32 black women. Joining us today is the medical director and assistant health commissioner of the Columbus Public Health Department, Dr. Myshika Roberts. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Roberts.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good.
Why is HIV high in the African American community compared to others?
Well, you know, I think you can look at a few different factors when you talk about HIV, specifically with the African-American community. I mean, one, you can't deny that there's a stigma in the African-American community about HIV, just like there's a stigma in many communities about mental health. And so that stigma, I think, one, prevents some people from getting tested, and then when they don't know their status, they can unintentionally spread it to others. So I think, you know, that is one barrier. And then I think another barrier is, and with that stigma comes lack of education, mm-hmm. lack of understanding about the disease, not only how it's transmitted, but now how fortunate we are to have so many drugs that we can use to treat the disease and really control the disease so that you don't spread it to others and you can live a productive life. The other would be access to care. The African American community, along with other minority communities, don't always have access to care, whether it's because they lack insurance, they don't have a provider, they're not making health a priority. So those two factors, I think, are some of the main drivers that are causing us to see an increase in rates in our African American community.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the incidence of HIV in the African-American community. It's much higher than it is in the larger community. My guest is Dr. Myshika Roberts. She's a medical director and assistant health commissioner at the Columbus Public Health Department. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You know, Dr. Roberts, this isn't the first time. In fact, I've been talking about this issue for literally years as far as the African-American community goes. What have been your greatest challenges in breaking through the stigma and in getting people properly educated about it?
Well, you know, I think we've seen so much advancement in the HIV community, and we've got some great individuals that are very powerful and, you know, celebrities that are very familiar with HIV, that being Magic Johnson. I think for our younger population, though, they see someone like Magic Johnson, they see him living a very productive life, and they think, oh, if I were to get HIV, I would be okay. I would be like Magic. And for what they don't understand is, you know, there's things you can do to prevent it. And so there leads to risky behavior at a younger age. And the majority of our HIV cases, our new HIV cases in the African-American community are in that younger age group, 20 to 29, who were not living at the time when HIV first came out and there was so much fear and there was lack of treatment. So that's a barrier, too, is really trying to get younger people, the younger generation, to practice safe sex to prevent HIV.
So it is a sexually transmitted issue in the African-American community. It's not an issue. Those risky behaviors is not so much IV drug use and needle sharing and that kind of thing.
No, actually, the risks for IV drug use, we only see it in about 1% of our cases. So the IV drug use is very small, and that goes across the board for all races.
And as far as the stigma goes, is the stigma about the disease itself, or is it about the behaviors that lead to it? In other words, same sex.
You know, that's an excellent question, and I think it's both. Obviously, in the African-American community, there are some that are still struggling with same-sex men who have sex with men or women who have sex with women, for that matter. And so they don't want to talk about it, and when they don't talk about it, it can shame those people who are living that lifestyle or exploring that lifestyle. They don't know where to go. They're hiding their behavior. And then thus, they might be practicing risky activities because they're hiding their behavior. And then they don't want to get screened. They don't want to get tested because they don't want to know, because then that's another thing that they're going to have to either hide from individuals that they really might love and look up to.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge. So I think it's that. And it's sex in general. You know, are we talking on a community level, not just in the African-American community, but are we talking on a community level about sex with our younger people? And that's important, because if they don't hear it from an adult and they don't hear the proper information, they could get misinformation from their peers.
So where can they get information from that makes sense for their circumstances?
That's another great question. I'm glad you asked, because, you know, we at the health department do some great programming with some of our younger generation. We do these in rec centers. We do these in some charter schools. We do these in some after-school programs, where the focus of our trainings with these young individuals is not just about safe sex, but it's really about empowering them to feel confident in their own self and to make good decisions. And what we found from these interventions that we do, these individuals do better in school, and they are less likely to be diagnosed with a sexually transmitted infection. And I'm not saying they're not having sex, but if they're having sex, they're practicing safe sex. And so those programs are available throughout our community. If you go to our website at columbus.publichealth.gov or publichealth.columbus.gov, you can get information. It's a program called TOPS. And we do a few different programs within the health department that target that population, that younger teenage population, to get them to, you know, make good decisions.
Does the same issue with HIV play out with other sexually transmitted diseases in that age group and in that demographic?
You know, we are seeing that when you look at gonorrhea and chlamydia, we're definitely seeing a higher number of cases in our African-American population and in our younger population. Definitely between like 15 years of age and 29 years of age, we see the most number of chlamydia and gonorrhea cases. The great news about gonorrhea and chlamydia, if there's a good news about it, is it can be treated and cured. HIV is a virus. We can treat it, but we can't cure it at this point. Research hasn't gone that far, but, you know, there's progress still to be made.
And as far as transmitting the disease sexually, this is a big problem among women as well. It's 1 in 16 African-American men, half as many among women, but still considerable, 1 in 32.
Correct. And if you look at the lifetime chance of someone getting diagnosed with HIV in Franklin County, 1 in 100 African-American men and 1 in 1,000 African-American women living in Franklin County, we estimate, will be diagnosed with HIV in their lifetime. So this is something that we have a lot of work to do. And obviously, we worry about females, because then they could transmit this to their child if they're pregnant or they choose to get pregnant. And we do know some women who find out they're HIV positive when they're pregnant. And there are interventions we can do and that we have access to help reduce the chance of spreading that infection to their unborn child.
When I've talked with people about this before, they have said that there is a lot of influence from the pulpit in the African-American community, and that there's a lot of negative messages that have historically come down from church leadership regarding homosexuality and that kind of a thing. Is that being addressed?
That is definitely true in terms of what I've heard and you know, what we know from talking to some individuals who've recently been diagnosed. There's still a lot of work that we as a public health agency and we as a community need to do to help spread this word and work with our churches to make sure they have the right information and they know what they can do to support their members and the community.
Lori in Union County, you're on the air with Dr. Mashika Roberts of the Columbus Public Health Department.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
My question is, apparently Planned Parenthood is going to be defunded in Ohio, and I'd like to know what the impact of that will be on particularly the Columbus, but in general, health departments throughout the state.
Well, thank you for that question, Lori. And obviously, that's a question that's very near and dear to our heart. And we try not to get into politics too much, but when things like this happen, we're kind of thrust into them. And, you know, there will definitely be an impact with Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthoods provide excellent public health services to our communities. They treat a lot of STDs. They screen a lot of STDs. And so that will be a loss to our community. Individuals will potentially will no longer have that as a resource. And there will be more expectations, and the public health system will need to try their best to pick up the cases and pick up the screening for those individuals. So at this point, it's really hard for us to say how much of an impact it will have on us and our public health, but we do anticipate there will be some impact.
Thanks a lot, Lori, for that question. This sounds kind of rudimentary, but for those who may be unfamiliar and don't understand, what is the difference between HIV and AIDS now? We usually refer now to just HIV. We don't talk about AIDS.
That's a great question. And so HIV and AIDS, you know, we often use those words together and sometimes don't differentiate. But from a medical standpoint, from a clinical standpoint, there is a difference. HIV means that you have the virus in your blood system and you have active HIV. AIDS is more of a clinical diagnosis, and it's based on criteria, one of which is what is your CD4 count. And your CD4 are cells that you have in your body that basically show a level of healthiness or immunity. And when you have a CD4 count under 200, then you are called, you are diagnosed with AIDS. There are other clinical factors too that would make a provider say someone had AIDS over HIV, and it basically is how far are you in the spectrum of HIV? How ill are you? So, you know, there are AIDS-defining illnesses like certain type of pneumonia infections that we see in individuals whose immune systems are very much compromised. And so that's how we differentiate HIV from AIDS. So it's a clinical diagnosis.
And as far as treating HIV, you said they've made great strides in recent years in almost normalizing the condition, which is kind of been part of the problem. People don't see it as much of a threat. However, the cost of these drugs, the cost to arrest the disease and live that normal life, it's still not cheap, is it?
No, it's not cheap. It's a very expensive disease to treat because the drugs are expensive and the care is expensive. We've made progress in that arena. Many people now can, if they don't have insurance, would be able to get on Medicaid. We also have a program that we're fortunate to have here in our community called the Ryan White Program, which will provide care and treatment, will basically serve as an insurance agent to individuals who have HIV or AIDS and may not meet their criteria to be on Medicaid. So that's a great benefit to our community that we have. And then we've made other advancements, too, in terms of trying to prevent this disease. Obviously, you know, we talk a lot about safe sex or abstaining from sex and knowing your status so you can practice the appropriate, you can reduce your risk. But also we have something, a new tool that we're pretty excited about here in our community called PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, which has been very effective in reducing the number of new infections when used properly.
How does that work? What does it mean?
So PrEP is a once-a-day pill that an individual would take to reduce or prevent their chances of getting HIV. You'd be taking a pill, and the pill is an antiviral medication. It's the same pills that some individuals with HIV take. Mm-hmm. And for those individuals who either have a partner who is HIV and they don't want to get HIV or is practicing unsafe sex with many partners that may or may not have HIV, this is a tool they can have and their doctors can prescribe for them to take this pill once a day so that they won't get HIV. And when taken appropriately, it is 99% effective in reducing your chances of getting HIV.
That's a huge breakthrough. And
huge
certainly,
breakthrough.
Yeah, right. Well, Dr. Roberts, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Mashika Roberts, she's a medical director and assistant health commissioner at the Columbus Public Health Department. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new survey of chief nurses in hospitals across the country has revealed that more than half of the facilities may not be using the best practices in their daily procedures. And many hospitals in the study didn't meet the standard scores on key performance measures. The question is, are those two factors related? Survey leader and dean of the College of Nursing at Ohio State University, Bernadette Melnick, joins us to talk about it. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
What, first of all, we've talked about it before, but can't say it, define evidence-based practices and why they're important.
Evidence-based practice is integrating the best evidence from well-designed research studies and combining it with the patient's preference and our clinical expertise. We know when all providers practice in an evidence-based way, patient outcomes are better by at least 28% to 30%.
Who decides what a best practice is? Is there a big list somewhere or what?
Yes. There are evidence-based guidelines. For instance, those that are rigorously produced by the United States Preventive Services Task Force. There are also very intense systematic reviews. Those are types of studies that look at multiple research projects that have been done, and they collate that information, analyze that data, and then put out what we should be doing based on that best evidence.
If they're proven to help but aren't being used everywhere, that tells me often, particularly chief nurses, are very, very busy. Who's supposed to keep up on this stuff? Who's supposed to be rolling them out in our hospitals?
That's an excellent question. There are a lot of hospitals that have quality improvement committees.
Yeah.
That's a group of folks that get together, analyze again the best evidence, and put out policies and procedures based on that. But Anne, you have to remember, just because we disseminate best practices does not mean we're going to change a clinician's behavior by simply providing that information. You've got to, one, give clinicians the skills and the knowledge. You know, a lot of programs, academic programs throughout the country, they're teaching students how to do research, but not evidence-based care, how to use that evidence and translate it quickly into daily care.
Why is it so hard to make that transition?
For one, because we still have PhD researchers who are wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, they generate research evidence for practice. They are teaching a lot of these courses. They have not themselves learned evidence-based practice. They know research. That's what they're teaching. EBP is different than research. EBP is using the research that's generated and translating that into daily practice.
When they're collating all of that, as you put it, is that, are they collating it into English that makes sense on the ground?
That's an excellent question, because again, you can't expect clinicians at the bedside to be able to have the same research skills as researchers to analyze. So you make an excellent point. The recommendations that come out have to be relatable, on the ground, practical for folks to understand. But there's a lot of barriers in the healthcare systems that prevent clinicians from implementing evidence-based practice. Time, culture. Mm-hmm. That's the way we do it here.
That's the way we've always done it.
That's it. And that so many people still live that across the country. You know, that's the way we learned it 20 years ago, and we're still going to keep doing it that way. So barriers continue to be pervasive in healthcare systems.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the extent to which hospitals across the country use evidence-based practices, those practices that have been shown through research to be successful. The problem is, if you don't use them, it doesn't work. My guest is Bernadette Melnick. She's Dean of the Ohio State School of Nursing and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State. If you have a question or comment about best practices and how they're implemented in hospitals, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Could you walk me through an example of research that has created a best practice and how it might be rolled out in a hospital?
You bet. Absolutely. Let's take children with asthma, for instance. Your child has an acute asthma attack. You take him or her to the emergency room. He or she gets administered a bronchodilator. Now, a lot of studies have shown when we give children bronchodilators with a metered dose inhaler and spacer, they do much better. They resolve their attack quicker. They're not admitted to the hospital as much. But emergency departments all throughout this country still give that bronchodilator medication with nebulizers instead of these metered dose inhalers and spacers.
Nebulizers are the thing we use with water. It kind of mists into your nose, right?
That's exactly right. So there are tons of these types of practices. Even most recently, let's take, for instance, a recommendation by the United States Preventive Services Task Force that all teenagers, all adults should be screened for depression in primary care when systems are in place to accurately diagnose and treat. Well, so many practices across the United States aren't following that recommendation because they'll say, we don't have a system in place to treat. So again, we put out so many guidelines, but we estimate people don't consistently follow them. And that's what the public needs to know. They need to ask. I have a little ask for evidence-based practice card that I share with people to remember to ask for evidence-based practice. A, ask your provider for the evidence behind what they're telling you to do or the screening tests or the treatment.
It's as simple as if they give you a nebulizer, ask them, why are you using a nebulizer instead of why this instead of that?
Exactly. Okay. To always ask, what's the evidence behind? If a provider recommends a screening test, it's important to say, why is this recommended? What is the evidence behind this? I think so often the public trusts us as providers and they take what we say as truth, right? As best practice. But consumers, people have to ask these questions because honestly, I hate to say it, but not everybody uses best evidence in their practice.
How many chief nurses were surveyed? And this was across the country.
It was.
And tell us about some of the responses, what your impressions are of what they're doing out there.
Yeah. So there were 276 chief nursing executives and officers at hospitals in 45 states throughout the country. What they told us was, we believe in the value of the evidence-based practice, but they themselves were not engaging in it, and they admitted that little was going on in many of these hospitals throughout the country.
Did they tend to be in hospitals that didn't have those best practices committee groups?
About 50% of these hospitals had evidence-based practice committees and so on. But again, just because you have a committee doesn't mean it's really happening. The chief nurses said their top priorities were quality and safety, so they should be right. But at the bottom of their priority list was evidence-based practice. And that told us there is a tremendous disconnect. They don't see evidence-based practice as the direct path to get their hospitals the quality and safety they need to have.
I said in the introduction that many of the hospitals in the study also didn't meet the standard scores on key performance measures. And the question is, are those two factors related? Were you able to relate those factors?
Absolutely. Well,
correlate, I should say.
Exactly. We can offer this as a major explanation for why they are not meeting these core performance metrics. It's scary to me personally that 400,000 people die every year from preventable medical error. So we could have a whole session just on safety, right, in the hospitals. But again, a contributing factor to some of those preventable deaths are the use of non-evidence-based practices. I was fanatical about evidence-based practice before I almost lost my daughter, Kaylin, in Australia from a ruptured appendix due to non-evidence-based healthcare. So I became even more fanatical about it after that happening to my daughter.
Is it possible that there are nurses, chief nurses out there listening right now thinking, it's easy for her to say that. She's not on the ground like we are on a day-to-day basis, maybe sometimes in an isolated hospital, maybe with not enough staff, often without enough staff. How in the world do we do this?
Yeah.
And since things are always changing, too, it's not static.
You bet. We have worked with hospitals and healthcare systems all throughout the country in helping them implement and sustain evidence-based practice. It is doable without exorbitant costs and resources. But you do have to put some investment into getting your staff these skills, the knowledge and the skills.
Right. So the difference between the nebulizer and the dosed inhalers, big thing. Yeah, first, you have to have the inhaler there.
Right.
It's accessible. And have them trained in how to use it and how to apply it.
Right. I was at a hospital in Alaska not too long ago where one of the nurses came up to me and said it was just ordered sugar paste for a pressure ulcer by an attending who was an older attending. And when she questioned him about why sugar paste, because we have much better effective treatments for pressure ulcers, his response was, oh, I've used this for 20, 30 years. This is so much better than the newfangled treatments. She brought him a systematic review from a wonderful Cochrane database of systematic reviews and said, but the evidence doesn't support us doing this. We need to use this
instead. All right. So there's another barrier, which is attending physicians.
Well, and I
they're the bosses usually, right?
Exactly. But the point is we have to question. We have to question and we have to give the evidence that we have. So, you know, never just take it as, okay, that's what they said to do. I'm going to do it.
The study found that almost half of the chief nurses interviewed were unsure of how to measure patient outcomes. What does that mean and what does it mean for patients?
So that was a very unsettling finding. The majority of these chief nurses held master's degrees. I absolutely. Here at Ohio State, we make sure even our bachelor's prepared students know how to look at outcomes of the care they're delivering. For instance, if you change a fall protocol on a medical surgical unit, you want to follow up in the months ahead to see, did changing that practice actually reduce falls, which is the outcome. We were blown away that so many chief nurses said, we never learned this in our programs. We don't know how to take a systematic approach to our nurses and the outcomes of their care. It's mind-boggling.
And so what, since they weren't taught how to do this, who's going to teach them?
We now do workshops. We were just in Rochester, New York, doing a workshop there for nurse leaders to make sure they have the skills. Because, again, they can't teach or support what they don't know. And then you got to build a culture for this throughout the institution. And all interprofessionals need to buy in as teams. Your doctors, your nurses, your pharmacists, your respiratory therapists. The teams have to say, this is the kind of care we are going to deliver on a consistent basis.
Bernadette Melnick, thanks as always for joining us today. I'm going to take a picture of those questions that patients can ask. I'll post it on Facebook so that everybody can see it. Otherwise, it's a nice little card. You can get it at the nursing.osu.edu/CTEP. We'll have that link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks, Bernadette, for joining us again.
You're welcome.
Bernadette Melnick, Dean of the Ohio State School of Nursing and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State. More Wellness Wednesday coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A few weeks ago, most of us had never heard of the Zika virus, but a suspected connection between the virus and a rash of serious birth defects in Brazil has quickly raised awareness. And yesterday, the Ohio Department of Health announced the state's first and second confirmed cases of Zika. Joining us now in the studio is OSU emergency physician and executive director of OSU's Health Sciences Center for Global Health, Dr. Diane Gorgas. Welcome back, as always.
Nice to see you, Ann.
So Zika spread rapidly through the Americas. It's up into Puerto Rico now, Haiti, and the World Health Organization has declared an international public health emergency. This felt like it came out of nowhere, but this has a lot to do with our better understanding of what some outcomes of Zika virus might be.
Yeah, exactly. Zika was a non-reportable disease for a long time. Really, the first human cases of Zika came up in the 1960s in West Africa, but there were only 14 reported cases in humans before 2007. It was only when it kind of made its way into Polynesia, and there was an outbreak in 13 and 14 there, and then subsequently made the jump across the Pacific into Chile and South America. And we started to realize that there were downstream consequences of the Zika infection with the birth defects, that it became trackable, and that we really started to pay a lot of attention to it.
I think at least one of the people that in Ohio that's been identified with Zika received it in Haiti.
Correct.
You're traveling to Haiti. It's part of what you do. It's been part of your personal mission as a physician for many years and of course, in your global health initiative as well.
Yeah. And I think that well-selected, well-informed groups of physicians and healthcare providers are really in need right now in these areas that are Zika affected. I personally know of three medical brigades who have canceled their plans to travel to Haiti because of the Zika virus. So what we're seeing is there's an increased need at the same time that there is an endemic infection.
Which reminds us, of course, of other outbreaks of other diseases.
Exactly.
Can you talk about the microcephaly for a minute and the birth defect called microcephaly, a baby born with a small head, deformed or and damaged brain?
Yeah, exactly. So microcephaly, by definition, is a morphologic characteristic. In other words, it's defined by having a small head and a small brain. It has varied effects on what that does cognitively and developmentally to the newborn. Some cases of microcephaly are mild enough that children are able to be mainstreamed and become productive members of society. Other forms of microcephaly really end up with profound disabilities associated with them.
And the symptoms of the Zika infection itself for an average healthy person are minimal. I probably have a worse cold right now than a lot of people feel from the Zika virus itself.
Well, I'm really sorry that you're sick. And
thank
hopefully
you. I just had to work that into my Wellness
hopefully
Wednesday.
Hopefully it is not Zika that
thank
you have. But
sure it's not.
Right.
I can cough for everybody if they want.
Perfect. Right. As a matter of fact, 80% of people that are affected with Zika have no symptoms. So to say that we have had the first two cases in Ohio of Zika virus means that we've had the first two identifiable cases, the first two symptomatic cases. But that's only 20% of the
who
population.
Who would go and even get it checked because they're feeling fine, right?
Exactly. And it does lead to some interesting questions about if you are a woman who becomes pregnant and has recently been in a Zika endemic area, should you be tested even though you don't have symptoms?
Is there anything, hypothetically, if you're tested, you're a pregnant woman who's been in a Zika infested area, you get tested, you have Zika or you've had it, if they can even tell if you've had it, is there anything you can do to stop microcephaly from occurring?
Not that we know of.
Okay. Because we don't know why that's happening.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's important. I think that you stated it very well in your opening comments that this is a suspected link with microcephaly. The reason that we suspect it is that we know that Zika is a virus that can attack the central nervous system. It's long been associated with a disorder called Guillain-Barré, which is a peripheral nerve abnormality where the virus attacks some of the piping for the nerves.
Can be very debilitating.
Paralysis.
I remember former Ohio Attorney General Betty Montgomery had it and was very ill.
Can be very it essentially causes paralysis and can leave you on a ventilator for months at a time. We know that Zika has a propensity for the central nervous system because of that. We suspect that Zika is associated not only from epidemiologic studies, that the rise of Zika within these areas within Brazil is also mirrored in the rise in microcephaly. And there have been some cases where Zika has been discovered in amniotic fluid and has been discovered in the fluid surrounding the brain and the spinal cords of babies affected with microcephaly. But we don't have that firm link. And since it is only happening in Brazil, we don't know that Zika is the only factor versus other environmental factors, genetic factors, co-infections, autoimmune, any one of a number of things could be contributing as well.
Once again, you're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about the Zika virus today with Dr. Diane Gorgas. She is an emergency medicine physician at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. She's also executive director of the Health Sciences Center for Global Health at OSU. If you have a question about the Zika virus and its transmission, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post a question there if you want. The virus has been shown to be transmitted sexually. That's a big issue.
It's a big issue.
Because before, you had to be bit by a mosquito, we thought, and that's the worst case scenario. You know, now we're talking about something much, much more serious.
So to put this in a local perspective, there are two types of mosquitoes that can carry the Zika virus that we know of. the most common of those carriers, that mosquito is really endemic to the Caribbean and the subtropical regions, but is known to have habitats in Texas, Florida, so reaching somewhat into the Gulf states and the southern U.S. The other mosquito that can carry the virus actually does have an endemic range that reaches as far as mid-Ohio, so right around Columbus. But it's not the major carrier.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the virus being spread by sexual contact, now we're talking about an entirely different vector, that it doesn't matter where you are and what mosquito lives in that region. It could turn into an endemic illness.
Are we sure that it's sexually transmitted at this point? Is it been shown that that's what did it? Or,
well, there are two factors that are going into that assessment. One is that we know that the virus is present in seminal fluid.
Okay.
And the second is that epidemiologically, looking at the Dallas case where it was transmitted through sexual contact, the index patient that came down with Zika had no other exposures to Zika other than a sexual contact who was infected.
And as far as the mosquito that has territory up into mid-Ohio, could it carry Zika by biting? If I have Zika, it bites me, it takes that, and it carries it to another person. Is that what we're talking about?
Right. That's exactly what we're talking about.
Okay. David in Upper Arlington, you're on the air with Dr. Diane Gorgas. Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I travel a lot working on development projects in El Salvador, Guyana, down into the Amazon. And I'm also a survivor of dengue in the past. And so I've really watched this close. And my question has to do, I think, with the mosquito. You just said that there was another one, but they're not as concerned about. And I think that might be the tiger mosquito. And the reason I'm concerned about it and have a question is because in the last 6 months, research has been published in either Science or Nature. I can't remember which of the two journals. But it had to do with, because the tiger mosquito exists in South America and in India, where it spread both ways from Africa originally, they've noticed that the tiger mosquito does two things when it infects people with chikungunya, one of the diseases, and that is that it also allows, it has an incredible ability to attack one person who has the disease, and literally they've timed it, and within 20 minutes it can ingest, incubate, and pass on to the next person after 20 minutes of incubation. The reason I bring that up is because that makes the tiger mosquito a particularly dangerous one. And with all the effort to do a genetic adjustment that sort of self-limits to one generation on the Aegyptus, which, you know, is our daytime mosquito, nobody's talking about the tiger mosquito, but the tiger mosquito is actually also reaching into the U.S. too. So because they don't know whether Zika is connected to Aegyptus for sure, nobody seems to be talking about the very high probability that it could be tiger, especially since the research in India showed that people that had chikungunya from the tiger mosquito within a few months often developed a form of encephalitis, which puts us into the category of, you know, the microencephaly, et cetera. So,
okay. Well, thank you, David. Diane Gorgas?
Yeah, I am the first to admit that I am not an expert entomologist, but everything that David says is really consistent with the reading that I've done on Zika as well, which is that at least there are these two mosquito vectors, and we know that that virus replication can happen within a mosquito, and that can cause person-to-person spread. Yes.
Yeah. Thanks again, David, for that call. To someone like David who's traveling there for work, what do you recommend people do?
That's a great question. At this point, the biggest at-risk population is women of childbearing age. So those who are currently pregnant, have plans to become pregnant, or who are not using birth control. the fetal exposure is the biggest risk. David referenced a couple other viral tropical diseases, dengue and chikungunya. Frankly, we know that the viral illness caused by both of those, both dengue and chikungunya, is more severe than the viral illness caused by Zika.
Uh-huh.
So as far as a risk to the patient, him or herself, I don't think that Zika is a tremendous concern. But the downstream consequences of Zika are really what we're concerned about.
Right.
And we need to make sure that anybody that needs to travel to those endemic areas is practicing safe sex when they return. And it will really become an issue during the warmer or summer months when mosquitoes are naturally out in central Ohio.
Jim in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Dr. Gorgeous. I have read on the internet, which of course we always take with a grain of salt, that correlating with this rise in microcephaly was also the practice of a DTaP vaccine that Brazil has really been pushing. And I was curious what your thoughts are about that.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And that's what that's where you have to separate causation and coincidence of disease pattern. There are a number of health benefits that Brazil has seen over the last year or two, including improvements in the quality of drinking water, trying to decrease overcrowding and housing issues, interventions in poverty. And you can look at any of those significant improvements and say, well, are any of those correlated with Zika as well? So there's been no scientific evidence, though, that has proved the causation between the diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus vaccine, and Zika.
Okay. Jim, thanks a lot for that question. We have an email from Ryan who asks, if a woman is infected with Zika virus, is she in danger of having a child with microcephaly for the rest of her life? If not, how long would it take before it would be safe to try having children? It's a really good question. I mean, how long does the virus live in those fluids?
That is a really good question, and it's such a new association that we have between Zika and microcephaly that we really don't definitively know the answer to that. Now, on a practical basis, we know that the Zika virus only lives in your bloodstream and is transmittable, theoretically, to the fetus for about a week to 10 days after infection.
And is that the same for the cases the mosquito's only going to get it from you if it's active in your blood system?
Yes. Theoretically, that is absolutely the case, that the virus has to be present in your bloodstream in order for the mosquito to have exposure to it and then
transmit
pass it on. Exactly. But we have not tracked this virus and the microcephaly associated with it for a long enough period to say what is the safe time period to become pregnant after infection.
Where do you recommend people go to learn more about Zika virus to understand it as things play out? I mean, this is such a moving target at this point.
Absolutely. The CDC is probably the best website associated with that. It's just cdc.gov. You can look locally at the Zika tracking within Ohio or within your area, wherever you're listening from.
And you can also
On the CDC website. Okay. And they will give you up-to-date information on a lot of these questions.
Well, Dr. Diane Gorgas, thanks for joining us. I think we're probably going to be talking about this for some time to come.
Absolutely. Thank you, Anne.
Dr. Diane Gorgas, she is an emergency physician at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center and also executive director of the Health Sciences Center for Global Health at Ohio State. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.